Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of How Full Is Your Bucket? Positive Strategies for Work and Life by Tom Rath and Donald O. Clifton, PhD. Narrated by Tom Rath, with additional narration by Jenna Stern. This book is copyrighted 2004 by the Gallup Organization. How did you feel after your last interaction with another person? Did that person, your spouse, best friend, co-worker, or even a stranger, fill your bucket by making you feel more positive? Or did that person dip from your bucket, leaving you more negative than before? Organized around a simple metaphor of a dipper and a bucket, this book reveals how even the briefest interactions affect your relationships, productivity, health, and longevity, and will show you how to greatly increase the positive moments in your work and your life. And now, how full is your bucket?
Introduction.
In the early 1950s, my grandfather, Don Clifton, was teaching psychology at the University of Nebraska when he noticed a major problem. The field of psychology was based almost entirely on the study of what is wrong with people. He began to wonder if it would be more important to study what is right with people. So, over the past 5 decades, Don and his colleagues conducted millions of interviews, focusing on the positive instead of the negative. Early in his research, Don discovered that our lives are shaped by our interactions with others. Whether we have a long conversation with a friend or simply place an order at a restaurant, every interaction makes a difference. The results of our encounters are rarely neutral. They are almost always positive or negative. And although we take these interactions for granted, they accumulate and profoundly affect our lives. During the course of Don's work in the 1990s, a new field of study emerged, positive psychology, which focuses on what is right with people. Today, many of the world's leading scientists study the effects of positive emotions. In 2002, Don's pioneering work was recognized by the American Psychological Association, which cited him as the grandfather of positive psychology and the father of strength psychology. That same year, Don learned that an aggressive and terminal cancer had spread throughout his body. Knowing his time was limited, he spent his final months doing what he did best and what people who knew him well would have expected, helping others focus on the positive. Although Don had already written several books, including the bestseller Now Discover Your Strengths, he asked me to join him in writing one last book, one based on a theory he created in the 1960s. People had been asking Don to write this book for decades as a result of the theory's popularity. Over the last 40 years, more than 5,000 organizations and 1 million people have applied this theory, and people always passed it along to friends, colleagues, and loved ones. Based on a simple metaphor of a dipper and a bucket, Don's theory carried profound implications and simplified his life's work for others. So in his final months, Don and I worked night and day to assemble the most compelling discoveries he had gathered over a half century of work. Although Don was undergoing chemotherapy and radiation, we continued to work on this book whenever he had the energy, which was the majority of the time. We sat in his study for hours, reviewing the research, statistics, and stories we thought you would find compelling. As Don's health deteriorated, I read sections to him and took notes on his feedback. He reviewed every section, wanting each story and insight to resonate with you. For my part, I was honored to be Don's partner in creating this book. He was my mentor, teacher, role model, and friend. We were exceptionally close, and I cherished the time we had together. I had always been motivated and inspired by his vision, and Don knew that I had been touched deeply by this theory throughout my life. As we will describe in Chapter 4, applying Don's theory of the dipper in the bucket energized and possibly saved me in my own battles with cancer. In hindsight, I think this project also gave Don additional energy in the final stages of his fight with cancer. He had spent his life trying to make the world a better place, one person at a time, and he understood that completing this book would make a difference. We finished our first draft of this book just weeks before his death in September of 2003. Over the 79 years of Don's life, he touched millions of individual lives through his books, teaching, and the global business he built. Don reached so many people as a result of his unwavering belief in helping individuals and organizations focus on what is right. As you listen to this book, we hope that you will discover the power of bucket filling in your own life.
The Theory of the Dipper and the Bucket.
Each of us has an invisible bucket. It is constantly emptied or filled, depending on what others say or do to us. When our bucket is full, we feel great. When it's empty, we feel awful. Each of us also has an invisible dipper. When we use that dipper to fill other people's buckets, by saying or doing things to increase their positive emotions, we also fill our own bucket. But when we use that dipper to dip from others' buckets, by saying or doing things that decrease their positive emotions, we diminish ourselves. Like the cup that runneth over, a full bucket gives us a positive outlook and renewed energy. Every drop in that bucket makes us stronger and more optimistic. But an empty bucket poisons our outlook, saps our energy, and undermines our will. That's why every time someone dips from our bucket, it hurts us. So we face a choice every moment of every day. We can fill one another's buckets, or we can dip from them. It's an important choice, one that profoundly influences our relationships, productivity, health, and happiness.
Chapter 1. Negativity Kills.
When we started writing this book, the first question I asked my grandfather was, "Why did you begin studying what is right with people?" Don answered my question without a moment's hesitation. His review of one specific case study had altered the entire focus of his career and life, and this study was about as far as possible from a positive or inspiring story. Following the Korean War, Major William E. Mayer, who would later become the U.S. Army's chief psychiatrist, studied 1,000 American prisoners of war who had been detained in a North Korean camp. He was particularly interested in examining one of the most extreme and perversely effective cases of psychological warfare on record, one that had a devastating impact on its subjects. American soldiers had been detained in camps that were not considered especially cruel or unusual by conventional standards. The captive soldiers had adequate food, water, and shelter. They weren't subjected to common physical torture tactics of the time, such as having bamboo shoots driven under their fingernails. In fact, fewer cases of physical abuse were reported in the North Korean POW camps than in prison camps from any other major military conflict throughout history. Why, then, did so many American soldiers die in these camps? They weren't hemmed in with barbed wire. Armed guards didn't surround the camps, yet no soldier ever tried to escape. Furthermore, these men regularly broke rank and turned against each other, sometimes forming close relationships with their North Korean captors. When the survivors were released to a Red Cross group in Japan, they were given the chance to phone loved ones to let them know they were alive. Very few bothered to make the call. Upon returning home, the soldiers maintained no friendships or relationships with each other. Mayer described each man as being in a mental, solitary confinement cell without any steel or concrete. Mayer had discovered a new disease in the POW camps, a disease of extreme hopelessness. It was not uncommon for a soldier to wander into his hut and look despairingly about, deciding there was no use in trying to participate in his own survival. He would go into a corner alone, sit down, and pull a blanket over his head, and he would be dead within 2 days. The soldiers actually called it give-up-itis. The doctors labeled it marasmus, meaning, in Mayer's words, a lack of resistance, a passivity. If the soldiers had been hit, spat upon, or slapped, they would have become angry. Their anger would have given them the motivation to survive. But in the absence of motivation, they simply died, even though there was no medical justification for their deaths. Despite relatively minimal physical torture, marasmus raised the overall death rate in the North Korean POW camps to an incredible 38%, the highest POW death rate in U.S. military history. Even more astounding was that half of the soldiers died simply because they had given up. They had completely surrendered, both mentally and physically. How could this have happened? The answers were found in the extreme mental tactics that the North Korean captors used. They employed what Mayer described as the ultimate weapon of war.
The ultimate weapon.
Mayer reported that the North Koreans' objective was to deny men the emotional support that comes from interpersonal relationships. To do this, the captors used four primary tactics. The first one was informing. The second, self-criticism. The third, breaking loyalty to leadership and country. And the fourth was withholding all positive emotional support. To encourage informing, the North Koreans gave prisoners rewards such as cigarettes when they snitched on one another. But neither the offender nor the soldier reporting the violation was punished. The captors encouraged this practice for a different reason. Their intent was to break relationships and turn the men against each other. The captors understood that the soldiers could actually harm each other if they were encouraged to dip from their comrades' buckets every day. To promote self-criticism, the captors gathered groups of 10 or 12 soldiers and employed what Mayer described as a corruption of group psychotherapy. In these sessions, each man was required to stand up in front of the group and confess all the bad things he had done, as well as all the good things he could have done but failed to do. The most important part of this tactic was that the soldiers were not confessing to the North Koreans, but to their own peers. By subtly eroding the caring, trust, respect, and social acceptance among the American soldiers, the North Koreans created an environment in which buckets of goodwill were constantly and ruthlessly drained. The third major tactic that the captors employed was breaking loyalty to leadership and country. The primary way they did this was by slowly and relentlessly undermining a soldier's allegiance to his superiors. The consequences were ghastly. In one case, a colonel instructed one of his men not to drink the water from a rice paddy field because he knew the organisms in the water might kill him. The soldier looked at his colonel and remarked, "Buddy, you ain't no colonel anymore. You're just a lousy prisoner like me. You take care of yourself, and I'll take care of me." The soldier died of dysentery a few days later. In another case, 40 men stood by as three of their extremely ill fellow soldiers were thrown out of their mud hut by a comrade and left to die in the elements. Why did their fellow soldiers do nothing to help them? Because it wasn't their job. The relationships had been broken. The soldiers simply didn't care about one another anymore. But the tactic of withholding all positive emotional support while inundating soldiers with negative emotions was perhaps bucket dipping in its purest and most malicious form. If a soldier received a supportive letter from home, the captors withheld it. All negative letters, however, such as those telling of a relative passing away, or ones in which a wife wrote that she had given up on her husband's return and was going to remarry, were delivered to soldiers immediately. The captors would even deliver overdue bills from collection agencies back home within less than 2 weeks of the original postmark. The effects were devastating. The soldiers had nothing to live for and lost basic belief in themselves and their loved ones, not to mention God and country. Mayer said that the North Koreans had put the American soldiers into a kind of emotional and psychological isolation, the likes of which we had never seen.
Studying positivity.
Moved by this story of psychological torture and deprivation, and perhaps inspired by the hope that these soldiers had not suffered or died in vain, Don Clifton and his colleagues decided to study the flip side of this horrific equation. They wondered, if people can be literally destroyed by unrelenting negative reinforcement, can they be uplifted and inspired to a greater degree by similar levels of positivity? In essence, they asked, can positivity have an even stronger impact than negativity? Their research to answer this question inspired the theory of the dipper in the bucket. The theory is based on the following principles. Everyone has an invisible bucket. We are at our best when our buckets are overflowing, and at our worst when they are empty. Everyone also has an invisible dipper. In each interaction, we can use our dipper to either fill or to dip from others' buckets. Whenever we choose to fill others' buckets, we in turn fill our own. The theory of the dipper in the bucket has been investigated, applied, and embraced by millions around the world over the past half century. People who have heard this theory found it to be inspiring and easily applicable in their everyday lives. Most importantly, it's a theory you can put to work to make your life better, right now. In this program, you will find a simple language to use and share with others, a summary of research discoveries that are applicable in your daily life, true dipper and bucket stories, ways to eliminate negativity from your workplace and life, and 5 proven strategies for increasing positive emotions.
Chapter 2. Positivity, Negativity, and Productivity.
Most of us will never endure the kind of psychological torture that the American POWs suffered during the Korean War. Yet we all experience positive and negative interactions every day that influence how we feel and behave. Just because these interactions are commonplace and often undramatic doesn't mean they do not matter. They do. While most of our negative experiences will not kill us, they can slowly but surely erode our well-being and productivity. Fortunately, positive experiences, or bucket filling, can be even more powerful.
Bucket filling in organizations.
Although bucket filling goes far beyond the concepts of recognition and praise, these are 2 critical components for creating positive emotions in organizations. In fact, we have surveyed more than 4 million employees worldwide on this topic. Our latest analysis, which includes more than 10,000 business units and more than 30 industries, has found that individuals who receive regular recognition and praise increase their individual productivity, increase engagement among colleagues, are more likely to stay with their organization, receive higher loyalty and satisfaction scores from customers, and have better safety records and fewer accidents on the job. To put this into perspective, think about the greatest recognition you have ever received in the workplace. Chances are, it caused you to feel better about your organization and, in turn, become more productive. Great recognition and praise can immediately transform a workplace. And just one person can infuse positive emotions into an entire group by filling buckets more frequently. Studies show that organizational leaders who share positive emotions have work groups with a more positive mood, enhanced job satisfaction, greater engagement, and improved group performance. One CEO we know, Ken, claims that bucket filling is his secret weapon as a leader. He has developed very targeted ways to increase positive emotions in the large organization that he runs. In Ken's frequent travels around the globe, he always stops by his company's local offices. And he doesn't stop by to spy on his employees or just to meet with upper management. Instead, his primary intent is to energize the people in each workplace. Before arriving, Ken recalls successes and achievements he has heard over the past few months involving people in that office. As soon as he arrives, Ken casually visits with these individuals and congratulates them. He may offer kudos to an employee who recently got married or had a child, or praise someone who gave a great presentation. His favorite line is, "I've been hearing a lot of good talk behind your back." The most enjoyable part of spreading positivity for Ken is to watch the energy move through the network once he sets it in motion. He realized that he could light up an entire workplace with a few brief but very energizing conversations. "I discovered that bucket filling is an extraordinarily powerful leadership strategy," Ken says. As a result of this approach, thousands look to him for motivation and guidance.
Killing productivity.
Of course, there is a flip side. Right now, the majority of us don't give or receive anywhere near the amount of praise that we should. As a result, we're much less productive and, in many cases, completely disengaged in our jobs. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, the number one reason people leave their jobs is because they do not feel appreciated. But the problem doesn't stop there. One study of healthcare workers found that when employees were working for a boss they disliked, they had significantly higher blood pressure. According to British scientist George Fieldman, this boss-induced hypertension could increase the risk of coronary heart disease by 1/6 and the risk of stroke by 1/3. There was both a statistically and clinically significant elevation during the time the people had the boss they didn't like, says Fieldman, a psychologist and psychotherapist. People who work with bosses they've really hated constantly for years would probably be quite vulnerable to heart disease because of the elevation of blood pressure in the long term. Where productivity is concerned, it would be better for organizations if people who are overly negative stayed home. When they do show up for work, they are counterproductive. We all know these types of people. They walk around the office with glazed looks or move from cubicle to cubicle, stirring up trouble with whining, complaining, and even paranoia. Our estimates suggest that there are more than 22 million workers in the United States alone who are extremely negative or actively disengaged. This rampant negativity is not only disheartening, it's expensive. It costs the U.S. economy between $250 and $300 billion every year in lost productivity alone. When you add workplace injury, illness, turnover, absences, and fraud, the cost could surpass $1 trillion per year, or nearly 10% of the United States' gross domestic product. These costs are not specific to the United States. They exist to varying degrees in every country, industry, and organization we have studied. And our figures are conservative. To estimate costs accurately, we only accounted for the direct impact that actively disengaged employees have at work. We quantified the productivity, or lack thereof, occurring in each person's own workspace. In analyzing the data, we had to assume that each disengaged employee simply sat in his or her cubicle and didn't wreak havoc elsewhere. An unlikely assumption, of course. Most disengaged employees do plenty of things each day that bring others down with their own sinking ship.
Spiraling downward.
To bring these numbers to life, here's an example of the effect that just a small dose of negativity had on one employee. Does Laura's story sound familiar to you?
There I was, standing at the front of the room, ready to get into the best part of my presentation. I'd stayed up late the last 2 nights preparing. I had a great deal of knowledge and passion on this topic and wanted everything to be perfect. And I really hoped to impress my boss and colleagues. Everything was going well as I flipped through the first few slides. Then, a sudden technology glitch gave everyone a chance to start talking for a few minutes. I overheard Mike whispering to Beth that it looked like I'd been out late last night. I wanted to jump across the table and strangle him. Did I really look that bad? I tried to remain composed, but I was shaken. When my presentation was back up, it was time to get everyone focused again and proceed. As I tried desperately to regain everyone's attention, my insecurities grew. Were my first few points so boring that they were dreading the next part? Or did I look so bad that it was undermining my credibility? Finally, my boss realized that I was about to have a breakdown and refocused everyone's attention. Unfortunately, he did it by saying, "Laura does not look very happy with us. Maybe we should pay attention now." Ouch. Sometimes I can't believe the things people say out loud. Every ounce of confidence I had mustered to give this presentation was wiped out. Things went downhill after that.
We have all experienced situations when it seems nothing will go right no matter what you say or do. Maybe you feel like everyone is out to get you, and you even start to fixate on negative things about yourself. Spiraling downward isn't hard to do when your bucket is being emptied. Not only do you feel down, but you are less productive because of it, and you bring others down with you by reactively dipping from their buckets. When you interact with people on these days, they quickly sense and are affected by the negativity you radiate. It's not easy to hide. In fact, it's highly contagious. It is possible for just one or two people to poison an entire workplace. And managers who have tried moving negative people to other departments to alleviate the problem know that location, location, location doesn't apply to these people. They bring their negativity along with them wherever they go. Negative employees can tear through a workplace like a hurricane racing through a coastal town.
Scaring off customers.
Not surprisingly, work groups drained by excessive bucket dipping aren't only less productive and less profitable. They also have higher turnover, more accidents on the job, and lower customer satisfaction, innovation, and quality scores. And negative employees scare off customers. Think about the last time you called a customer service line and were treated poorly. After this experience, you might have said to yourself, "I'm never doing business with this company again." If you were really angry, you might have told others about your experience and recommended that they stop doing business with the company as well. This is the damage one negative employee can inflict on any business. Recently, we investigated the impact that a single employee can have on customers by studying 4,583 call center representatives from a major telecommunications company. We discovered three service representatives who scared off every single customer they spoke with in a given day, and those customers did not return. It is a serious problem when a company's employees are dipping from customers' buckets. The company would have been better off paying those three representatives to stay home. Fortunately, this study also identified seven service reps who retained and engaged every single customer with whom they spoke. Maybe you've been lucky enough to talk with a rep like this, one who listened to your problem, made sure you understood that you were heard, took care of your issues promptly, and left you feeling like he or she really cared about you as a person. Did you want to tell others about this first-class service? And are you still a customer to this day?
The recognition gap.
Managers, take note. Praise is rare in most workplaces. One poll found that an astounding 65% of Americans reported receiving no recognition for good work in the past year. And we have yet to find anyone who reports suffering from over-recognition. No wonder so many employees are disengaged. Although we need and want recognition and praise, the fact is we don't get enough, and organizations suffer because of it. Most of the time, organizations begin formal recognition programs because someone in upper management has decided that monthly or quarterly award ceremonies will help raise employee morale. Sounds good, right? What happens is the old reliable Employee of the Month program. For the first few months, the program might actually work. There are usually at least a couple of people who have been top performers for a long time and deserve more recognition. These stars are appropriately showered with public praise. But after a while, management struggles with the inevitable question, who should be the next Employee of the Month? Once the executives reach a compromise, a lucky manager must stand in front of the room and say a bunch of nice, and often insincere, things about the recipient. The whole exercise ends up feeling like a sham to both the winner and the presenter. Eventually, everyone, regardless of merit, gets named Employee of the Month. All their smiling photographs appear on a board in the reception area. But the whole thing is gratuitous, and everyone knows it. The one who feels the worst, of course, is the employee who receives this recognition last. Why wouldn't he? Management waited months, or maybe more than a year, to praise his great work, which probably feels about as good as being picked last for a team in gym class. Of course, some organizations do provide meaningful, deserved, and individualized recognition. In Chapter 6, we provide suggestions on how your organization can do just that. Sincere and meaningful bucket filling increases the morale of any organization. Managers and employees who actively spread positive emotions, even in small doses, will see the difference immediately. And creating that difference can be inexpensive or even free. All it takes is a little initiative.
Chapter 3. Every Moment Matters.
Usually, we don't stop to consider the impact of brief interactions, but we experience literally hundreds of potential turning points in a given day, as illustrated by Tammy, a single mother with three children.
My day starts with a typical rush. As I'm trying to get ready for work, the kids are clamoring for breakfast. Although my 8-year-old and 11-year-old are content with cereal, my 6-year-old is demanding peanut butter and banana on toast. Eventually, I give in and make one piece as requested, and we sit down for a quick meal. After a single bite, my 6-year-old drops her breakfast on the floor. I watch in what feels like slow motion as it lands, chunky peanut butter side down. Her brother blurts out, "You made a mess," then her older sister says, "You're supposed to eat it, you dummy," and I chime in too and tell her something she already knows, that she really should be careful next time.
Consider how it felt to be the 6-year-old at that moment. What if Tammy had quickly hit pause in her mind and given her daughter some positive encouragement instead of piling on and pointing out her mishap? Tammy's day continues.
I finally get everyone out the door and the kids to school, just in time. Then, as I'm driving into the lot at work, I thought I had finally caught a break. For the first time in recent memory, there is an open parking spot in the front row. So, I speed up a little to make sure I beat any other parking lot predators to the spot. Of course, the minute I get close, another driver has the same idea. Even though I know in my head that I was there first, I decide to defer to this woman with a courtesy wave, and I head toward the back of the lot. Then something strange happens on the way into the building. The driver is waiting there, holding the door for me as I enter the building. She introduces herself and thanks me for being so kind. We end up chatting for a while.
In the span of a few moments, the buckets of both women were filled. Tammy continues.
I get into the office, sit down in my less-than-spectacular cubicle, and check my electronic calendar. I see that my 10 a.m. appointment reads, "Performance Review with Bill." My stomach just sinks. I want to run home and call in sick. I know exactly what this means. Bill, my boss, must have interviewed my peers the day before and asked them all about my opportunities for improvement. Sure enough, the meeting confirms my suspicions. Bill has prepared a list of 8 things that I need to work on fixing over the next 6 months. Not once does he mention any of my recent successes, even though I had worked more than 70 hours last week to complete a major proposal. After what feels like a couple days, I leave his office in a lousy mood. I think to myself, why do I even stay with this company?
In a short period of time, Bill all but emptied Tammy's bucket. She continues.
Later on, I'm walking down the hall, and I run into Karen, one of the company's top executives. We had worked together briefly on last week's big proposal. As I pass Karen, she slows down and says, "Hi, Tammy. That was great work on the final section of our proposal last week." I'm just amazed that she even remembered my name. More than half of the people in my work group call me Tamara, which isn't even the name I prefer.
If Karen had just said, "Hi, Tammy," that might have been enough. But offering Tammy meaningful and specific praise made her day. Her bucket was filled quickly. And the funny thing is, Karen might have thought she was just making a simple comment in passing. She probably couldn't imagine the positive impact.
Our negative culture.
Most of us want more positive emotions in our lives. We want to feel like Tammy did in her brief meeting with Karen more often, and like she did after her performance review less often. 99 out of every 100 people report that they want to be around more positive people. 9 in 10 report being more productive when they're around positive people. Unfortunately, wanting a more positive environment isn't enough. Most of us have grown up in a culture in which it's much easier to tell people what they did wrong instead of praising them when they succeed. Although this negativity-based approach might have evolved unintentionally, it nevertheless permeates our society at all levels. This focus on what is wrong is particularly evident in our school experiences. Instead of celebrating what makes each child unique, most parents push their children to fit in so that they don't stick out. This unwittingly stomps out individuality and encourages conformity, despite these parents' good intentions. And our schools, which are built around core curricula that students have to learn regardless of their interests or natural talents, reinforce this kind of thinking. When a child excels at a subject and receives an A, what happens? Rather than recognizing and developing areas of talent, teachers and parents skip past the A and focus on raising the lower grades on the report card. And very few principals or guidance counselors are known for calling students into the office to discuss outstanding grades. A recent Gallup poll measured parents' focus on their children's best grades compared to their focus on their worst grades across multiple countries and cultures. The question posed to parents was, your child shows you the following grades: English, A; Social Studies, A; Biology, C; Algebra, F. Which grade deserves the most attention from you? The vast majority of parents in every country focused on the F. Unfortunately, parents get caught up in the how can I get my kid into college race instead of first considering what's best for the development of their sons or daughters. This isn't to say that parents should ignore the F in algebra, but why not start with a positive focus on the A's before working on strategies for improving the F? If parents at least begin these discussions on a more positive note, it could make for a more productive conversation. At least when students graduate and enter the working world, they have the opportunity to do what they want, right? This is their time to pursue their grand passions. Well, that may be true for a select few. Unfortunately, the majority of young people aren't selected for their first job on the basis of how well their natural talents fit their role. Think back to your first career-oriented job and see if this scenario sounds familiar. Essentially, you were hired for a job, then you were expected to change who you were to fit the role. If you struggled, then you may have had to endure a competency program designed to fix the problem. The weakness-based approach follows us throughout our lives, from school to the workplace.
They missed it.
More than 70 years ago, the fields of education and psychology overlooked an important study, one with implications that could have, and probably should have, altered the ensuing focus of human inquiry. It's possible that we've all been suffering from this oversight ever since. The study, conducted by Dr. Elizabeth Herlock in 1925, was designed to explore what would happen when fourth and sixth grade students in a math class received different types of feedback on their work. Herlock wanted to find out if it was more effective to praise, criticize, or ignore students. The outcome was to be determined by how many math problems each student had solved 2, 3, 4, and 5 days later. Children in the first group were identified by name and praised in front of the classroom for their good work. Children in the second group were also identified by name in front of the group, but they were criticized for their poor work. Those in the third group were completely ignored, although they were present to hear the others being praised and scolded. A fourth control group was moved to another room after the first test. Members of this group took the same tests, but they received no comments on their performance. Students in both the praised and criticized groups did better after the first day. Then their performance changed dramatically. The students who were criticized showed a major decline in their test scores, and by days 3 and 4, they were performing on par with students who had been completely ignored. In contrast, the students who were praised experienced a major improvement after day 2 that was sustained through the end of the study. By the 5th day of this experiment, the group that received praise showed unequivocally stronger performance than the other study groups. The overall improvement by group was praised 71%, criticized 19%, and ignored 5%. You would think this study caused quite a stir among psychologists and educators, but it didn't. Until recently, the scientific community has focused almost exclusively on studying the effects of negative or traumatic moments. That focus is finally starting to change.
The emergence of positive psychology.
As a result of the positive psychology movement, the study of what is right with people, some of the world's leading academic minds are now devoting their careers to analyzing the effects of positive emotions. At the risk of greatly oversimplifying a decade of in-depth research, many of the world's most noted scientists have put negativity on trial and have found it guilty. These recent studies show that negative emotions can be harmful to your health and might even shorten your lifespan. We already know that one negative person can ruin an entire workplace, but negative emotions can also destroy relationships, families, and entire careers. In contrast, recent discoveries suggest that positive emotions are an essential daily requirement for survival. Not only do they improve your physical and mental health, but they can also provide a buffer against depression and illness.
Thousands of moments every day.
According to Nobel Prize-winning scientist Daniel Kahneman, we experience approximately 20,000 individual moments in a waking day. Each moment lasts a few seconds. If you consider any strong memory, positive or negative, you'll notice that the imagery in your mind is actually defined by your recollection of a precise point in time. And rarely does a neutral encounter stay in your mind. The memorable moments are almost always positive or negative. In some cases, a single encounter can change your life forever. In a recent Today segment, Katie Couric interviewed a young man named Brian Bennett, who had grown up in a troubled and abusive environment. He had struggled in school and had been picked on regularly at a young age. Now, Brian is a successful and well-adjusted adult. When Couric asked him, "What made the difference?" the young man responded without thinking twice. The defining moment in his life occurred when a grade school teacher simply told him that she cared about him and believed in him. This one small interaction turned Brian Bennett's life around. In another case, we asked Kristen, a management consultant, "What is the greatest recognition you have ever received?" Her answer? 3 words in an email. We then found out that when Kristen's mother passed away, a mentor at work whom Kristen had admired throughout her career wrote her a special note. Her mentor's email concluded by saying, "Your mother was very proud of you, and so am I." After 25 years with her company, 3 simple words carried more meaning than any other recognition Kristen had received in her entire life.
The magic ratio.
Of course, few moments are this profound, but even less memorable interactions are important. Positive psychology experts are finding that the frequency of small, positive acts is critical. John Gottman's pioneering research on marriages suggests there is a magic ratio of 5 to 1 in terms of our balance of positive to negative interactions. Gottman found that marriages are significantly more likely to succeed when the couple's interactions are near that 5 to 1 ratio of positive to negative. When the ratio approaches 1 to 1, marriages cascade to divorce. In a fascinating study, Gottman teamed up with 2 mathematicians to test this model. Starting in 1992, they recruited 700 couples who had just received their marriage licenses. For each couple, the researchers videotaped a 15-minute conversation between husband and wife and counted the number of positive and negative interactions. Then, based on the 5-to-1 ratio, they predicted whether each couple would stay together or divorce. 10 years later, Gottman and his colleagues followed up with each couple to determine the accuracy of their original predictions. The results were stunning. They had predicted divorce with 94% accuracy, based on scoring the couple's interactions for 15 minutes. This ratio is critical in the workplace as well. A recent study found that work groups with positive to negative interaction ratios greater than 3-to-1 are significantly more productive than teams that do not reach this ratio. Fredrickson and Losada's mathematical modeling of positive to negative ratios, however, also suggests the existence of an upper limit. Things can worsen if the ratio goes higher than 13-to-1. So while this book focuses primarily on ways to increase positive emotions, it's important to note that we don't recommend ignoring negativity and weakness. Positivity must be grounded in reality. A Pollyanna approach, in which the negative is completely ignored, can result in a false optimism that is counterproductive and sometimes downright annoying. There are times when it's absolutely necessary to correct our mistakes and figure out how to manage our weaknesses. But most of us don't have to worry about breaking the upper limit. The positive to negative ratios in most organizations are woefully inadequate and leave substantial room for improvement.
Increasing longevity.
Negative emotions can lead to serious problems. Thousands of studies have revealed the damaging results of stress, anger, and hostility on the mind and body. In contrast, positive emotions can buffer us against adverse health effects and depression. They enable faster recovery from pain, trauma, and illness. And positive emotions might lead to an increase in lifespan. Researchers who studied 839 Mayo Clinic patients over a 30-year period found a link between optimism in how people explained life events and a lower risk of early death. And a landmark study of 180 elderly Catholic nuns revealed that nuns with more positive emotions live significantly longer than nuns with fewer positive emotions. The researchers studied handwritten autobiographies each woman had written in her early 20s. The frequency of positive emotions in these early writings was scored and compared to mortality rates for these women when they were 75 to 95 years old. The results were staggering. The nuns who reported experiencing more positive emotions lived on average about 10 years longer. Even more startling was the fact that 25 nuns in the group with fewer positive emotions had passed away at the time of study, compared with only 10 deaths in the group with more positive emotions. To put this in perspective, consider that cigarette smoking has been shown to reduce life expectancy by 5.5 years for males and 7 years for females. So, negative emotions might cut more years off life expectancy than smoking. There's no Surgeon General's warning about negative emotions, but there should be.
Physical and mental health effects.
In addition to extending our lifespan, positive emotions can improve our daily physical and mental well-being. A study of Harvard graduates revealed that the way in which young men explain negative events, pessimistically or optimistically, predicted several physical health outcomes decades later. Specifically, optimism early in life predicted good health later in life. Other studies suggest that optimism can ward off and shorten the duration of the common cold. Based on studies that analyzed blood counts, optimists were found to have more T4, or helper cells, that fight against infection. Optimists have also been found to average less than one doctor visit per year, where pessimists average more than 3.5 per year. Increasing the positive emotions in your life might even help to minimize your healthcare costs. It's clear that positive emotions directly affect our physical health, but what about our mental health and interactions with others? Barbara Fredrickson, director of the Positive Emotions and Psychophysiology Laboratory at the University of Michigan, has done a great deal of research on this subject. She reports, "Positive emotions do much more than merely signal well-being. Positive emotions also improve coping and produce well-being. They do so not just in the present, pleasant moment, but over the long term as well. Positive emotions are not trivial luxuries, but instead may be critical necessities for optimal functioning." Indeed, Fredrickson concludes that positive emotions protect us from and can undo the effects of negative emotions, fuel resilience and can transform people, broaden our thinking, encouraging us to discover new lines of thought or action, break down racial barriers, build durable physical, intellectual, social, and psychological resources that can function as reserves during trying times, produce optimal functioning in organizations and individuals, and improve the overall performance of a group when leaders express more positive emotions. It appears that science is just now beginning to scratch the surface on this topic. After centuries of studying mental illness, experts are finally investigating and attempting to measure mental wellness.
This ends Disc 1. How full is your bucket? Disc 2.
Chapter 4. Tom's Story, An Overflowing Bucket.
As you listen to this program, you may be wondering, isn't being positive or negative genetic and somewhat hard to change? The short answer is yes. We all know people who seem to be, and probably are, born with a negative predisposition. and you undoubtedly have met people who seem innately, irrepressibly positive. The scientific community has varying views on this matter. Some studies suggest that positivity and negativity are primarily rooted in nature. Others argue for nurture. The most common theory right now is that both nature and nurture make a significant and possibly equal contribution. Noted psychologist Ed Diener describes how our capacity for happiness has a baseline measure, much like our physical weight. Just as some people are predisposed to be thin no matter what they eat, some have a natural tendency to be happier than others. But our level of positive emotions can certainly rise or fall a great deal based on what happens to us over time. And it would not hurt most of us to go on a diet consisting of more positive emotions and fewer negative emotions. Regardless of an individual's innate starting point, regular bucket filling can increase his or her positive emotions. To illustrate the long-term impact, we decided to share a personal story.
A birthday present.
Shortly after we started working on this book, I realized that Don's birthday was right around the corner. Since we were creating a book about positive emotions, I decided to write him a letter detailing the importance of bucket filling in my own life. I figured this birthday present would have more meaning than a standard gift. And knowing that Don was facing an uphill battle with cancer, I thought this was the right time to express my appreciation and gratitude. When I was young, I remember Don saying that we should gather to celebrate all the great things that a person has done while they're still around to be a part of the celebration. When he went to funerals, it bothered him that so many people waited until they were eulogizing a loved one to liberally fill his or her bucket. "Why not do this while they are alive?" he would ask. So on Don's 79th birthday, I shared my personal story with him. When he read it, he was moved to tears. A few days later, Don asked if I would consider sharing my story in this book. He thought it would be a good illustration of continuous bucket filling, and I agreed. What follows is the story I gave to Don on his birthday. It is an account of how regular bucket filling shaped my own life while I was growing up.
Searching for early traces of talent.
As the first child of my generation in a large extended family, I benefited from a unique method of child rearing. It certainly defied the conventional wisdom at that time. From the day I was born, each member of my family was determined to help me focus on what I did best. They provided constant support and encouragement. By the time I turned 4, my mother and grandmother had spotted my keen interest in reading, so they would sit with me for hours on end, helping me learn to read. This teaching, nurturing, and attention made a real difference. Whenever relatives dropped by, they would ask what I was reading or pose specific questions about the activities I enjoyed. It is now easy to see they were looking for early cues to my natural yearnings and talents. The minute my family noticed my passion in a certain area, they encouraged me to learn as much as possible on that topic. They were never shy with their praise and always quick to compliment even the smallest accomplishments. Then, when I was about 8 or 9, the bucket fillers who surrounded me noticed my entrepreneurial spirit, and they could tell that I enjoyed leading my peers. So when I was 10, my grandfather, Don, suggested starting my own business. I loved the idea and decided to open a snack stand. As always, the rest of my family was thrilled to help me pursue a new passion, and they rallied around this project. After a few months, this little enterprise was doing well. Biz Kids had enough business to move beyond buy-in from the local wholesale club, and a major candy distributor agreed to give our company a bulk rate and deliver to our location. We eventually moved beyond snacks, expanding into selling apparel and small merchandise. By the time I was 12, the operation employed more than 20 of my classmates, and we had made a couple $1,000s in real profit to share amongst ourselves. After a few years in business, this story landed on the cover of the local newspaper and was picked up by national newswires. All of the caring, attention, and genuine bucket filling were making a major difference in my life. My bucket was overflowing, and this allowed me to concentrate on filling the buckets of everyone around me. At the end of each month, I would give out awards and commission checks based on how much each person had sold. It was fun to watch as my own bucket filling lifted the spirits of my friends, family members, and very young coworkers. This focus on positive encouragement continued throughout my education. My parents asked about my favorite classes and extracurricular activities on a daily basis. And instead of dipping from my bucket when I wasn't doing well in music or art courses, they encouraged me to focus more time on the areas that gave me personal satisfaction. They noticed that I was quite analytical and enjoyed numbers and current events, so they recommended that I spend more time studying mathematics and the social sciences. Even though I was already an A student in those areas, my family realized there would be a much greater return on my education if I devoted more time to the subjects for which I had a natural passion. Unlike most of my teachers and my friends' parents, my parents were not determined to make me well-rounded. Given that my rhythm seems to have been surgically removed at birth, they understood that pushing me to be a better musician was fruitless. I might get to average at best. A popular saying in my home was this age-old maxim: never try and teach a pig to sing. It wastes your time and it annoys the pig. As a young student, I found this quite liberating. I didn't have to try and be good at everything. Instead, I was able to strive for greatness in my areas of natural talent.
A safe and welcoming home.
In contrast to my own home, I recall how strange it felt when I visited a friend's house in grade school. We would walk in the door, filled with after-school energy, and the first thing his mother would say was always along the lines of, "Did I say you could have a friend over again? Did you get in trouble at school again? Or, you better not have flunked that test." Maybe what she said was warranted sometimes, but I was amazed that the first thing out of his mom's mouth was always so negative. Another one of my classmates would arrive home each day to find a handwritten list of negative notes on her bed with phrases like, "You need to improve your attitude." These were not very welcoming environments, especially when I was used to going to my house and hearing things like, "How was school today? What do you feel like doing this afternoon? Do you want to show me any of the work that you did today? Or, did you guys get to play basketball in gym class today?" Which my mom knew was our favorite sport. At first, I thought these friends must have had troubled families, but over time, I found out this was common. In hindsight, I wonder if this explains why my friends and I spent so much time at my house while growing up. When we were there, our buckets were filled with positive support and encouragement. My house was a kind of home base where we could go to refuel on positive emotions before returning to the negativity-laden real world.
Confronting a major challenge.
My life continued to unfold in this positive way until I was 16. At that point, I started experiencing poor vision in my left eye and confronted my first big life obstacle. Doctors discovered multiple tumors in my left eye and performed several major surgeries. A year later, all sight in my left eye had been lost, permanently. On top of that, the condition indicated a possible genetic abnormality that causes sporadic tumors to grow throughout the body. The results of a DNA test confirmed that I had this extremely rare disorder, von Hippel-Lindau disease. As a result, tumors were likely to show up in my pancreas, kidneys, eardrums, adrenal glands, brain, and spine with no advance warning. Upon hearing this news for the first time, I was shocked and nervous. But on some level, I was surprised by how little the news dampened my spirits. From that day forward, instead of dwelling on the negative or uncontrollable aspects of this disease, my family helped me focus on what could be done. Although there was a strong degree of apprehension in my mind, I never got depressed. At a crucial moment, that kind of genuine caring and positivity had a remarkable influence. Within the first week of finding out about my condition, I immersed myself in learning how to manage and live with this disorder. When friends would ask me about losing vision in my left eye, I would be quick to point out that the vision in my right eye was 20/10, much better than average. Looking back, the key was not viewing my prognosis as any type of curse or death sentence. Instead, I saw it as an opportunity to be proactive and to stay on top of my physical health. After continuing to learn more about this rare disease, I discovered that most of the tumors associated with my condition were manageable with early detection and treatment. I resolved to measure my progress with regular scans and checkups. In the meantime, Things continued almost exactly as they had before, socially, athletically, and scholastically. My everyday life did not change. Over the next several years, the only time I thought about my condition was every 6 to 12 months, when it was time for medical checkups. Sure, waiting for the results of my MRI and CT scans made me anxious, but I managed to keep those feelings in perspective. In many ways, my confidence and spirit were stronger than ever. My approach was to confront these challenges head-on. I'm not sure I was totally conscious of my attitude at the time, but I didn't let these problems overwhelm me. A decade later, my close friends would admit how frightened and concerned they were for me during that time. But they also recalled being mystified by my positive attitude. Although they knew I stayed on top of things, they could not believe my lack of day-to-day worries about this condition. In retrospect, it was as if I had acquired some strange type of mental immunity that no one could understand. But there was nothing strange or incomprehensible about it. The daily drops in my bucket from friends and family had built a reserve in my bucket that was sustainable during tough times.
A surplus of positive emotions.
While I was in high school, my family members continued to point out specific strengths they would notice, which helped a great deal in shaping my priorities and ambitions. By my junior year of high school, it was clear to me that I wanted to study psychology in college. I loved research and learning about what makes people tick. So I searched out and applied to schools across the nation with strong psychology programs. Of course, my family was incredibly supportive of my going away to college. They helped with applications and went with me on visits to several schools. My family's positive support enabled me to quickly adjust to a new college environment. Even though they were more than 1,000 miles away, they still managed to fill my bucket on a regular basis. During my first 3 years of college, everything went smoothly. Unfortunately, there were more challenges ahead. In my senior year of college, an exam revealed a tumor in one of my adrenal glands. 5 years later, doctors found cancerous tumors in my kidney. While working on this book, scans revealed several new tumors on my pancreas, adrenal glands, and spinal cord. In each case, there was some fear and initial frustration. But my most memorable reaction was a sense of relief in knowing that these tumors were caught before they could metastasize and spread to other organs. My vigilance and awareness of the disease had paid off. Each condition could be managed with surgery. So I reviewed as many articles as I could find on each condition, wanting to fully understand my surgical options and the associated risks. All of my energy was focused on what could be done. My energy was not focused on what had already occurred or aspects beyond my control. To this day, I have never stopped in my tracks and asked, "Why did all of this happen to me?" I mean it. I may have been frustrated, but I never rallied against fate, and there's a big difference between the two. Personally, I saw no good reason to sit around and dwell on the negative or feel sorry for myself in these situations. It would get me nowhere. Besides, such wallowing could have worsened my emotional and physical health. Although the threat of facing various forms of cancer is with me every day, I see no alternative other than to focus on what can be done to stay ahead of this disease. And I can honestly say that it's easy to maintain this attitude on a daily basis. Why? That's simple. After almost 3 decades of life, I cannot recall a single day when my bucket wasn't filled over and over again by family members and friends.
We all need full buckets.
My case is obviously an extreme example of bucket filling. It might even sound contrived to me if I were hearing this story for the first time. But let me reassure you that every word is true. Given my ongoing physical challenges, this high-dose bucket filling has literally been a lifesaver. We are all certain to face major challenges as we progress through life. Often, we feel as if we were dealt a bad hand and that life is unfair. But we don't have to allow ourselves to be defined by our hardships. Our responses to difficult events and our emotional state are much more important. Positive reinforcement about our strengths can buffer us against getting overwhelmed with the negative. And understanding what we do best allows us not only to survive, but grow in the face of adversity.
Chapter 5. Making It Personal.
The personal story you just heard is admittedly unusual, but there are countless examples of people whose lives were made better and more productive by frequent bucket filling. In fact, you can see this happening in great workplaces all the time. Remember that customer service representative in Chapter 2 who treated you so well when you called in with a problem? Let's say you were so impressed that you asked for his name. And let's also say that you called back later to tell Ted's supervisor what he had done to win you over. As you were giving details about his friendly voice or efficient problem-solving technique, his supervisor was scribbling notes as fast as he possibly could. 30 minutes later, as Ted completed a call in which he won over yet another irate customer, yes, he does this all day, he got a new email message from his boss. The first thing Ted noticed when he opened the message was that his boss had copied a group of Ted's closest friends from work on the email. The subject line read, "You made a difference today." Ted's eyes immediately moved to the text of the message, where his supervisor described exactly what Ted had done to win you over. As he detailed the scenario for Ted and his peers, he dropped in several direct quotes from your conversation. Ted's supervisor ended the note by explaining how Ted's actions not only satisfied a customer, but also made that person's day a lot easier. As Ted was reading the note, he could barely contain the giant grin on his face. Though fatigued from a long work day in which multiple customers berated him, he was suddenly rejuvenated by the message. Ted's boss knew the key to great bucket filling. Recognition is most appreciated and effective when it is individualized, specific, and deserved. Clearly, he understood that writing an email and copying Ted's peers would cause Ted's bucket to overflow. And perhaps Ted's boss also knows that the same approach won't work for Ted's colleagues, some of whom may prefer a quiet pat on the back or perhaps more boisterous praise in a meeting. The point is, there are unique and specific ways to fill each person's bucket, and most certainly inappropriate ways as well. Generic, one-size-fits-all awards don't work. Neither does recognition that seems forced or false. And sometimes the recognition you think will inspire an employee backfires in the worst and most public way.
The nightmare scenario.
Consider the true story of Susan, a manager, and her stellar customer service representative, Matt. The following events transpired at a large insurance company that Gallup consulted with in the 1980s. When Susan became a division manager in this organization, she quickly learned that her success would hinge on her ability to inspire her customer service group toward better performance. At one point in her career, Susan was a customer service rep herself, and she just loved to win big awards and hear the ovations when she stood up in front of a crowd of her colleagues. During the workday, she would look up at some of her favorite plaques on the wall and remember the rush she felt from winning an award. That really got her going. So, Susan decided to set up a major awards ceremony to recognize her customer service reps. She held the event at the finest hotel in the city. She invited all of the reps and their families to the celebration, and she hired a well-known speaker and some first-class entertainers. The last portion of the program was the major year-end recognition for the individual reps with the best annual performances. To further highlight Matt, the top producer, Susan would save his award for last. She wanted that presentation to be the night's main event. The drape-covered easel on the stage inspired a lot of chatter and anticipation. Susan hoped this award would motivate Matt for years to come, so before announcing that Matt was the top producer, Susan detailed a long list of all the star employees' accomplishments and showered him with praise. Then, she pulled the drape off the award and held the prize over her head as she read Matt's name. This was the moment Susan had been scripting in her head for the past few weeks. She had even imagined the delighted look on Matt's face. To Susan's amazement, just the opposite happened. Matt was furious. The painful expression on his face and his hostile body language spoke volumes. The angry rep walked to the microphone and proceeded to tell the group that he didn't even want the award. It was just a plaque and had no meaning for him. Plus, he had a bunch already. He didn't need one more. It was the worst night of Susan's life. Not only had this debacle hurt the morale of the group, Susan now needed to figure out a way to win back her best customer service representative. So, after Susan got over the shock of the whole affair, she started to think about how she could acknowledge Matt in the future.
A one-size-does-not-fit-all approach.
Susan started by learning more about Matt. She discovered that this star employee loved nothing more than his two young daughters. Whenever Matt talked about them, his face lit up. At the office, he was always showing off the newest pictures of his daughters. The next year, Matt was again one of the top customer service reps. Susan was determined to get the award ceremony right. She had called Matt's wife and asked her to take the two girls to the best photographer in the area for a formal portrait and to keep it a secret. When the big night rolled around, everything was in place. Susan began the ceremony by talking about a very special man. She described not only the top customer service rep, but the passionate family man as well. Then, Susan unveiled the beautiful portrait of Matt's two lovely daughters. Matt immediately rushed toward the stage and embraced Susan. His eyes were filled with tears. Everyone in the room was moved. Matt couldn't have imagined a more meaningful and personal kind of recognition. It changed the way he looked at his boss and job forever.
Individualize, individualize, individualize.
The lesson here is clear. If you want people to understand that you value their contributions and that they are important, the recognition and praise you provide must have meaning that is specific to each individual. Not only is individualized bucket filling more effective in boosting productivity in the workplace, it builds sustainable relationships and changes people's lives forever.
Chapter 6. 5 Strategies for Increasing Positive Emotions.
To increase positive emotions in your life and others' lives, you must make a habit of filling buckets. This isn't news to you. By now, we know that our relationships, careers, and lives will be much more fulfilling if we increase the flow of positive emotions around us. But just knowing this isn't enough. Like any goal in life, you must have specific, actionable plans to transform good intentions into reality. So we examined our database of more than 4,000 open-ended interview responses on this topic and narrowed the list down to the 5 strategies that are most likely to produce results.
The 5 strategies. Strategy 1, prevent bucket dipping. Strategy 2, shine a light on what is right. Strategy 3, make best friends. Strategy 4, give unexpectedly. Strategy 5, reverse the golden rule. Strategy 1, prevent bucket dipping.
Just as we have to start eliminating debt before we can truly save, we must start to eliminate bucket dipping before we can truly begin to fill buckets. After hearing the theory of the dipper in the bucket, one man we know decided to put it to the test. He was looking for a way to eliminate his own dipping from others' buckets. So he developed a simple habit of asking himself if he was adding to or taking from the other person's bucket in each interaction. He told us it was a difficult habit to get into at first, but after some time, he realized it was working. By catching himself before he uttered a negative comment, and in some cases making a more positive one instead, he started making himself and the people around him feel better. For the next few days, try to catch yourself in the act of bucket dipping, then stop it. Consider your most recent interactions. Have you poked fun at someone? Touched on an insecurity? Blatantly pointed out something the person does wrong? If so, try and push the pause button in your head next time. Once you've successfully curtailed your own bucket dipping, encourage similar changes among those around you. Are people in your work group or school chronically criticizing or mocking others? Do you ever notice them teaming up and group dipping from someone's bucket? The next time you see bucket dipping in progress, do something about it. Convince others that unwarranted negativity only makes matters worse. The reality is that some persistently negative or hurtful people simply won't change despite your best efforts. They've got long-handled dippers and they intend to use them. If serving as an example won't help, then steer clear of these kinds of people as much as possible, for your own well-being and emotional health. Once you've consciously started to eliminate bucket dipping, keep track of your progress by scoring your interactions. That's right. Reflect on your last few exchanges with another person. Decide if, overall, each interaction was more positive or negative. Score each one as either a plus or a minus in your head. Write them down if you need to. We've provided a worksheet on our website at www.bucketbook.com to help. Were the majority of those interactions positive or negative? Now, as you consider what it would take to fill the buckets of your friends, family, co-workers, and others, ask yourself, what would it take for me to reach that magic ratio of 5 positive interactions for every 1 negative interaction that I heard about in Chapter 3?
Strategy 2. Shine a light on what is right.
Each interaction gives us the chance to shine a light on what's right and fill a bucket. A friend of ours recently discovered the power of focusing on what is right. Unhappy in her marriage, she had been after her husband for weeks to make changes. He didn't seem interested in spending much time with her, and when she complained, he got defensive. So she drew even more attention to the things that upset her, hoping he would notice. Instead, she found that things seemed to get worse. Realizing that telling her husband how much he disappointed her wasn't working, she tried an experiment. She began to draw attention to the things he did well and what she liked about him. She was skeptical, but she had nothing to lose. What do you think happened? After several days, her husband was happier when he came home and more engaged in the relationship. Eventually, his attentiveness and warmth began to fill her bucket, just as her positive outlook towards him had filled his. But the most unexpected thing was that she felt happier on her own by focusing on the positive rather than dwelling on the negative. And this, in turn, caused her to be much more positive in her interactions with other people. After a few weeks, both she and her husband were passing this newfound energy along to friends and coworkers. Never underestimate the long-term influence of filling others' buckets. Dr. Barbara Fredrickson says that positive emotions create chains of interpersonal events, the far-reaching results of which you may or may not get to see in person, but they are there and happening. Every time you fill a bucket, you're setting something in motion. Consider this. If you fill 2 buckets a day, and the owners of those 2 buckets go on to fill 2 new buckets, more than 1,000 buckets will have been filled at the end of 10 days. If each of those same people filled 5 buckets instead of 2, more than 19 million buckets would be filled in just 10 days. So continue the chain. When someone fills your bucket, accept it. Never brush it off and diminish what that person is doing. Fill their bucket in return by saying thank you, letting them know that you appreciate the compliment or recognition. In turn, you are more likely to share your renewed positive energy with others. Do you want to see how much bucket filling you do compared to others? On our website, you'll find a 15-question positive impact test designed with just that purpose in mind. The test was created to help you determine if you are filling buckets on a regular basis. We encourage you to complete this assessment right away so you have an initial score that indicates whether you have low impact, some impact, or a high impact on your environment. You will also be able to see how your score compares to others based on results from a Gallup poll. Don't be concerned if your score is low at first. This assessment was designed to provide you with a measure for continuous improvement. The questions evaluate key areas of your progress. To be even more intentional about your progress in bucket filling, consider printing the list of questions from the website and use them as a guide for improvement. Send the link to friends if you want to see how your score compares to theirs. It might be interesting to identify the best bucket fillers in your work group, circle of friends, or family. Try it out now and again in a few months. See if your score improved.
Positive impact test questions.
1. I have helped someone in the last 24 hours. 2. I am an exceptionally courteous person. 3. I like being around positive people. 4. I have praised someone in the last 24 hours. 5. I have developed a knack for making other people feel good. 6. I am more productive when I am around positive people. 7. In the last 24 hours, I have told someone that I cared about her or him. 8. I make it a point to become acquainted with people wherever I go. 9. When I receive recognition, it makes me want to give recognition to someone else. 10. In the last week, I have listened to someone talk through his or her goals and ambitions. 11. I make unhappy people laugh. 12. I make it a point to call each of my associates by the name she or he likes to be called. 13. I notice what my colleagues do at a level of excellence. 14. I always smile at the people I meet. 15. I feel good about giving praise whenever I see good behavior.
Strategy 3. Make best friends.
In grade school, kids often stick with sports teams, cheerleading, music, or other extracurricular groups, even when the activity isn't a clear fit for their interests. If they're experiencing no push from parents and having little success, then why do they stay involved? Maybe it's the same reason why employees stay with organizations that are less than ideal, or even unhealthy. They probably have a best friend there. If you think about it, most of us join and stay with groups, teams, and organizations because of our best friends. We say best friend because our study of great workplaces found that having friends, good friends, or close friends on the job was not as important as having a best friend at work. People with best friends at work have better safety records, receive higher customer satisfaction scores, and increase workplace productivity. Even though the term best friend does imply some exclusivity, it doesn't necessarily mean you should limit yourself to one very close friend. We would even go as far as to recommend that you have several relationships of the best friend caliber among your workplace, home, and social circles. Great relationships lead to a significant increase in life satisfaction. Noted psychologist Ed Diener found that the happiest people have high-quality social relationships. On the other hand, Diener and other researchers have found that lonely people suffer psychologically. Consider some of your best relationships. They were probably formed through an early series of positive interactions. You're not likely to become good friends with someone if the majority of your initial interactions are negative. Remember this during your first interactions with a new acquaintance. Start by learning the names of people you see regularly. And for each one, make sure you learn the name he or she prefers to be called. Sure, this may seem like a small thing, but it can make a major impression. It's tough to build relationships until you know someone by name. Your acquaintances may soon become friends. Whether you want to build many relationships or just a few deep ones, your best approach is to fill a person's bucket in your very first interaction. This is a powerful way to initiate new relationships and to strengthen your existing relationships. In fact, your friendships are unlikely to survive, let alone thrive, without regular bucket filling. Put this concept to work today. Begin with the most important people in your life. Tell them how important they are to you and why. Don't assume they already know. Even if they do, they'd probably love to hear it anyway. Continue to learn more about what builds them up. Be a catalyst for an even more trusting, lasting, and positive relationship. Listen to your friends with unconditional, positive regard. Support them in their endeavors. Encourage them. Be a mentor, or at least be the person they know they can always go to for a kind word. But don't stop the process with family and friends. At work, become the person known for noticing when others do a great job. Learn something new about each person you work or interact with. Create positive interactions with acquaintances, even strangers. You might start to notice that more and more people want to be around you.
Strategy 4. Give unexpectedly.
In Chapter 3, we mentioned a Today segment in which a troubled student described how the encouraging words of one teacher turned his entire life around. Well, there were a few other twists to Katie Couric's segment that morning. As soon as the young man, Brian Bennett, finished telling his story, Couric surprised him by bringing his teacher onto the set. Brian's face lit up as she walked out with her husband, who had been one of his favorite high school teachers. As it turns out, these two mentors just happened to be Barbara and Mac Bledsoe, the parents of NFL All-Star quarterback Drew Bledsoe. After they visited with one another, Couric announced that she had another surprise for Brian. Drew Bledsoe walked out and gave Brian his jersey and football. Brian was overwhelmed with positive emotions as a result of this unexpected gift. According to a recent poll, the vast majority of people prefer gifts that are unexpected. Expected gifts do fill our buckets, but for some reason, receiving things unexpectedly fills our buckets just a little bit more. It's all about the element of surprise, and the gift doesn't have to be anything big to be successful. Luxury retailer Saks Fifth Avenue conducted an experiment in which sales associates surprised customers who were known to shop infrequently with a small gift. Although it was a mere token of Saks appreciation, the customers loved it, and the sales associates did too. This program helped grow the store's business by transforming casual shoppers into regular customers. An unexpected gift doesn't have to be tangible either. It can be a gift of trust or responsibility. Sharing something personal or entrusting a friend with a secret can fill his or her bucket. In your own interactions, look for opportunities to give small gifts to others out of the blue, maybe a funny little trinket, a hug, or an offer to grab a cup of coffee. Even a smile can be an unexpected and cherished gift. Consider unexpected sharing as well. What books, articles, or stories could you send someone that would positively influence his or her day? In the spirit of unexpected giving, here's a gift from us to you. We want to share with you something that's already helped more than 1 million people discover their strengths. It's the product of decades of Gallup study. It has been used in 48 countries, and it is the cornerstone of several of Don's books, including the national bestseller Now Discover Your Strengths. It's called the Clifton Strengths Finder. Don created this web-based assessment to help people uncover their talents. Research shows that people who complete this assessment and learn about their strengths are more confident, more positive, more productive, and have more direction in their lives. And they're also more likely to focus on the strengths of other people and thus fill their buckets. We hope that taking the Clifton Strengths Finder assessment and learning about your natural talents will fill your bucket and, at the same time, make you a world-class bucket filler. Inside this audiobook packaging, you will find an invitation card with a unique 16-digit ID code that will allow you to take one Clifton StrengthsFinder assessment free of charge. Upon completion, you will receive a customized guide that will get you started on building your top 5 themes of talent. We hope you take advantage of this opportunity to see inside yourself and share what you discover with others.
Strategy 5. Reverse the Golden Rule.
In the case of bucket filling, do unto others as you would have them do unto you doesn't apply. Instead, we suggest a slight variation. Do unto others as they would have you do unto them. We devoted Chapter 5 to illustrating this point, but we want to reiterate. When it comes to robust and meaningful bucket filling, individualization is key. So when you're bucket filling, go ahead and reverse, or at least redefine, the Golden Rule. As you learned from Matt, the customer service representative who received the portrait of his daughters, the things that make you unique also determine what really fills your bucket, and vice versa. It's unlikely that the exact same things will mean quite as much to anyone else. Some of us prefer tangible rewards or gifts, while others are driven by words and acknowledgement. And while certain people want to receive kind words in front of a crowd, others prefer a quieter, one-to-one commendation or compliment from someone they love, admire, or respect. Another important aspect of individualization is this. What we recognize in others helps them shape their identity and their future accomplishments. This is why bucket filling must be specific to the individual. Not sure how to start? Just ask some questions. We've included a few for you to consider. Try them out on your friends. If you're a manager, Discover the power of asking your people these questions and then acting on them. More information is available at our website.
The Bucket Filling Interview.
1. By what name do you like to be called? 2. What are your hot buttons, hobbies, or interests you like to talk about a lot? 3. What increases your positive emotion or fills your bucket the most? 4. From whom do you most like to receive recognition or praise? 5. What type of recognition or praise do you like best? Do you like public, private, written, verbal, or other kinds of recognition? 6. What form of recognition motivates you the most? Do you like gift certificates, a title for winning a competition, a meaningful note or email, or something else? 7. What is the greatest recognition you have ever received? In addition to being individualized, it will mean more to the recipient if your praise is specific. Putting praise into writing or email is a great way to do this. Written recognition is also especially rewarding because it serves as a lasting acknowledgement, something the recipient can reflect on over and over again. Visit bucketbook.com to send an electronic drop for your bucket or to create a printable drop. These are two simple ways to provide written recognition. Feel free to use this system or make up your own. Whatever works best for you and each recipient. Drops have been used in businesses, schools, and places of worship for more than 3 decades. Millions of people have used them. Some people have kept the drops they received for many years as a reminder of their accomplishments. Here are a few comments we've heard from people who have used drops.
Drops are compliments. They're a way of telling a person you've done an outstanding job or thank you for what you've done.
Drops create positive energy where none previously existed.
Anybody can send a drop to anybody else, so it isn't top-down or bottom-up. Drops can come from any direction. This is not management patting someone on the head and saying, "Yes, you've done a good job, and we hope to get more out of you."
A drop can be a thank you or a moment in time when you caught someone doing something great and understood or appreciated what they did. I think a drop is a way to capture an interaction or moment with someone and say, "I noticed this about you. I care about you, and I want you to know it."
Try it. Do it. Write drops and encourage others to do it, too. I think people will get excited about the concept and not wait to get agreement from everybody about it. Try it in a small area within your organization and see what happens.
I'm now going to read for you the actual text from a drop that I wrote to Don when I was 11 years old to thank him for the idea of starting the business I mentioned in Chapter 4. A drop for your bucket, dated 11/4/1982. Thanks for giving me the idea of starting BizKids. It has really helped me learn about business. I think it was a great idea, and I'm very glad I pursued it. BizKids is now successful because of your excellent ideas. Love, Tom. Now here's our challenge. Set a goal to write at least 5 drops or other forms of recognition every month. If you need to, print a few drops from our website and set them somewhere where you'll see them to help you remember to take the time to compose them. If you don't like writing by hand, you can type them or send electronic drops from bucketbook.com. The site will also allow you to set up bucket-filling reminders in case you need a few prompts. Once you're done writing a drop, you can quietly slip the note to the recipient in person, send it, email it, or read it out loud with fanfare. Do whatever fills his or her bucket most. This is the essence of great bucket filling.
Epilogue.
Imagine what your world will be like 1 year after you have engaged in daily bucket filling. We suspect the following changes will have occurred. Your workplace will be a lot more productive and fun. You'll have more friends. Your colleagues and customers will be more satisfied and engaged. Your marriage will be stronger. You'll enjoy closer relationships with your family and friends. You'll be healthier, happier, and well on your way to a longer life. There's plenty of scientific and anecdotal evidence to demonstrate the importance of bucket filling in our lives. Take every opportunity to increase the positive emotions of those around you it will make a big difference. It may even change the world. Don't waste another moment. A bucket somewhere is waiting for you to fill it.
The end. You've been listening to How Full Is Your Bucket? Positive Strategies for Work and Life by Tom Rath and Donald O. Clifton, PhD. Narrated by Tom Rath, with additional narration by Jenna Stern. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Positive Words, Powerful Results by Hal Urban, narrated by Nelson Runger. Although we live in an ocean of words, we rarely acknowledge their power to uplift or put down, to inspire or discourage, to help or to hurt. But in this jewel of a book, Hal Urban, parent and award-winning teacher, shows us simple and immediate ways that we can use language to change lives, both our own and those around us. We also recommend Life is a Series of Presentations, 8 Ways to Punch Up Your People Skills at Work, at Home, Anytime, Anywhere, by Tony Jeary, with Kim Dower and J.E. Fishman, narrated by Rick Rowan. Tony Jeary, known as Mr. Presentation, is coach to America's top CEOs. In this useful guide, Jeary offers 8 ways in which to approach presentations with flair and confidence. Through anecdotes and lists of essential principles of presentation, all listeners will learn how to impress an audience. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call the toll-free number found on the back of this book. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse our catalogue, place orders, hear about our latest releases, or tune in to narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.